Summer is supposed to be an opportunity to slow down, but when you look at your kids, you can't help but notice that your kids are growing up fast. Help them build independence as they grow with Greenlight. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families where parents can keep an eye on kids' money habits while kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. It's the easy, convenient way to raise financially smart kids. Get your first month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/pod.
Corbin Carroll, Austin Riley, Randy Arozarena, Bo Bichette. I could go on and on and on, but instead let's talk with Frank Stanfill from CBS Sports about some disappointing hitters. Coming up next on 90 Feet From Home. What's going on, everybody? Thank you so much for joining me here on episode 23 of the 90 Feet From Home Fantasy Baseball Podcast. We are presented by Underdog Fantasy, and I am your host, Joe Orico. You can check me out over on Twitter, at JoeOrico99. That's where you'll find all of my new work, articles, podcasts, and all of that great stuff. But we have bigger fish to fry because Frank Stanfill is joining me on the show today. I was about to say he's returning to the show, but it's a new podcast, so he's technically not returning, but if you listen to the old show, Frank was one of the more popular guests that I had over there. I've got to hang out with him in person a few times. Really great guy. You can check him out over at CBS hosting the Fantasy Baseball Today podcast. And of course, on Twitter, at @Roto_Frank. Frankie Stamps, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing very well. Busy time of year. We're, you know, right in the middle of the baseball season at this point. There's obviously lots to talk about, but I'm happy to be here with you, Joe. Thanks for having me, man.
Of course. Always a great time getting to catch up. Anything going on? I know there's a lot going on at CBS, but anything you want to let the people know about, upcoming podcasts, articles, or anything like that before we get going?
Yeah, so we are in the middle of it. As I mentioned, Fantasy Baseball Today, we got coming out every weekday. We go live on YouTube Sunday through Thursday night. The audio podcast comes out Monday through Friday. We also have a 5-minute podcast, which accompanies that, which, you know, I get as the season goes along, maybe people don't have the time that they did earlier in the season to dedicate to it. So if you need a shorter podcast, 5 minutes, we usually hit on the biggest headlines or, you know, the biggest performances from the night before. So Fantasy Baseball Today, that's the hour-long podcast. And then our Fantasy Baseball Today in Five, that's a 5-minute podcast if you need something a little bit shorter.
Definitely check out everything that Frank has going on. It's a great show. It's in their feed pretty much every day. You take some time off on the weekends like we do over here, but always great stuff coming out over at CBS. Like I mentioned, we are brought to you by Underdog Fantasy, and you guys should really be checking out Pick 8. It is now live for the NBA Finals. You create entries with up to 8 picks, and Underdog will automatically double flex your entry. So you can miss up to 2 picks and still end up winning the game. With more picks and extra ways to win, the excitement is higher than ever, and you can win up to 325 times your original amount. If you use my code Joe99, you'll get a special pick with also a $250 bonus in deposit cash. Frank, let's talk about what's gone on a little bit this season. How have your teams gone? We're nearing the 50% mark of the year, which feels insane already. It feels like we were just out on the golf course in Arizona a couple weeks ago, but it's been almost 6 months at this point, since that point, and 3 months into the year. What are your big takeaways and how have your teams looked so far?
Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway, and we'll talk about this throughout the course of this podcast today with some disappointing hitters, is the offensive environment just changing from year to year. And obviously, pitching has dominated so far this season, and overall, the offensive environment has been down. Home runs are down, batting average, BABIP, it's all down, and hopefully it gets better as the weather heats up. That's typically how it goes, but it's been especially down, even compared to other previous years, April and May. So I don't know if it's related to the baseball or whatever it might be, but that's been a problem, and I see that in a lot of my teams, right? So look, I have 16 fantasy baseball teams, which is like probably double how much I actually should have, maybe even more than that. And you know, if you have that many teams, it's going to be mixed results. I have, you know, some teams where I'm competing, NL Labor, I'm in like the top 4 or 5, and TGFBI, I think I'm in the top 3. I'm also in last place in my Tout Wars League, which obviously I don't want that to be the case, but that's just the way the cookie has crumbled so far. So you have enough teams, results are going to be spread out. Obviously I would love to win every team. I'm super competitive. I actually kind of like beat myself up and really think about like, what did I do wrong when things are going wrong? But we'll have all off season to kind of dissect and figure things out. But yeah, It's been mixed results and a very weird offensive environment so far.
I was talking about this a couple weeks ago with Jeff Erickson. It seems like every night I'll go and check the pitching logs. And it's like, okay, 12 innings, 14 strikeouts, 2.2 ERA. That's good. And we go to the hitters and it's 2-for-21 with a single run scored. And it's like, I was going through my NFBC teams the other day and I have 12 NFBC teams, 14 in total. And all of them, except for one, have more pitching points than hitting points.
Yep.
I'm sure there are people who are in the reverse situation, but it just feels like every team is struggling with the offense. You mentioned Tout Wars. My Tout Wars team is seventh as of today, or as of yesterday. I haven't checked today, but I'm dead last in homers and RBI. My pitching has been very good. Good stolen bases, good on base. Dead last in homers and ribbies. And I think that is something that is plaguing a lot of managers this season. Is the ball different? I have no idea. I don't think we have any real way of knowing until maybe Dr. Meredith Wills or somebody starts carving into some of these baseballs in the offseason or maybe throughout the year, and we'll maybe figure it out. But it's very hard to plan your teams around an environment where we don't know if it's going to be changing or not. The first day of June, we saw this offensive outbreak. It was like the Chris Sale Oakland start and a ton of stuff. And everybody was saying, oh, we got the June baseballs now, but it's kind of settled down a little bit. So I don't know if we can necessarily even point to, you know, now that it's June, the balls are different. As the season, as the weather warms up, I think things will improve, but it's definitely been a huge, huge struggle. We're going to talk about roughly 10 guys today who have really disappointed us. And I don't know how you put together a disappointing hitter outline without starting with Corbin Carroll. The guy has been awful. There's no two ways about it. I only have him on one team, thankfully, and it was where he had fallen to, like, I think it was 10th or 11th, and I was like, okay, I'll take a Corbin Carroll share. I wish I had taken literally anybody else there. We're looking at 204 batting average, two homers, 11 stolen bases, not hitting the ball hard at all, hard hit rate, barrels both down. I've been on the train of there's probably a shoulder injury here, and I think a lot of people have thought that for a while, but we're at the point now where it's like, wouldn't they have just told us if there was a shoulder injury? It's been 3 months. There was something plaguing him at the end of last year, it looked like, as well, but I don't know what the Diamondbacks really gained from keeping it a secret. What is your thought process on Corbin Carroll? Is he still a buy low? Is he a sell low? Do you think he'll turn it around? Is there any way of really knowing?
I don't know that there's any way of knowing right now. I think we're kind of in a holding pattern right now, because even if you tried to sell based on where you drafted him, can you get another top 3 or 4 round player in return for Corbin Carroll right now? Like, that's 75 cents on the dollar. I don't even think you can get that. I think you would have to sell even lower. So if I have Corbin Carroll, I would just cross my fingers and hope that he refines that form from last year. On the other side of it, look, if you could buy really low, we just talked about how much pitching surplus is out there. If you picked up, I don't know how realistic this is, but I'll just throw it out there. I mean, there's a bunch of crazy leagues. Like, if you have an overperforming Seth Lugo, or like Carlos Rodon has been awesome, or all these pitchers have jumped up throughout the season, Jared Jones and Shota Imanaga, maybe not Imanaga, but someone like that, who's just like overperformed, someone you picked up late or whatever it might be, like, yeah, throw it out there. You can try and get Corbin Carroll on the cheap, but there's no way around it. You said it. I mean, he's the biggest bust in fantasy to this point. First round ADP. He currently ranks 295th in the Razzball player rater. Everything that can go wrong has gone wrong so far with Corbin Carroll. And I was pretty much off of him. I was very open about this, where I was kind of worried about that shoulder, and the power came down in the second half last year. And, you know, he didn't really, like, he was all right in the postseason, but didn't really hit for power. You mentioned, like, the quality of contact is way, way down so far this season. It could just be a classic sophomore slump, but I think it's more likely related to that shoulder, because he had shoulder surgery back in 2021. Last year, you'll remember that he hurt his shoulder on a swing the first time on June 29th, and then he did it a second time about a week later after that. But since he first hurt his shoulder, June 29th of last year, Corbin Carroll has played 140 games during that span up until now. He is batting .244 with 10 home runs and a .376 slug. If that's not, like, it's just so clearly correlated to when that injury happened, where things just completely fell off. So I don't know why they would keep it under wraps, like you said. I mean, I feel like there are lots of injuries that happen where there's just, like, kind of baseball politics involved, where they don't want to reveal this information. You find out after the season, this guy was playing through this thing all season. I don't know why they would keep it such a secret. They've moved him up and down the lineup. They've tried to figure things out. It hasn't happened. If you could buy really, really low, I would say go for it. In terms of if you have him on your team, I think it's just a hold for now.
Yeah, I think I agree with everything you said. If you're selling him, it's very unlikely you're getting back anything that's that valuable. So he is probably just somebody you got to hold. I had a couple of drop questions recently about him in a 10-teamer, and it's just you can't cut him because the upside is still immensely high. I think if you are able to trade him and get anything in the first five rounds worth of value, even a top 100 player at this point, I think it's probably wise. But it's also like, maybe he figures it out next week and maybe he ends up as a 75th overall player for the season. That also wouldn't shock me. I just don't know why there is this relative lack of transparency. Like, we see injuries pop up all the time. It's not like it's a contact sport where we're going to have to be dealing with people targeting him or something. I just don't know. I don't know why they've gone about it like this. It seems like
clear, we don't know that is for sure what's happened, right? Like, we're here speculating.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem like there's any other reason for why this has happened. And again, it's pretty clearly correlated to when that injury happened. But we don't know for sure that's the problem. It could legitimately just be a sophomore slump.
That's true. I was surprised that he didn't really miss any time last year with the injuries. Like, you figured they would even give him a couple weeks off. I don't even think there was an IL stint in there. He played 155 games, so I don't think there would have been.
He didn't.
It's kind of surprising. I don't really understand it, but maybe we're off base and there's actually not something wrong with him and it's just a slump, but it really does seem like that shoulder has been impacting him. Let's talk about Austin Riley. I'm not sure what to make of Austin Riley at this point. I think that he is a much preferable buy than Corbin Carroll. If I just look below the surface at the data with Riley, nothing really to be overly concerned about, but the stat sheet is 3 home runs, 20 ribbies, a .230 batting average. Are you willing to buy him, or are you starting to think that maybe this is just not Austin Riley's season?
I would be looking to buy Austin Riley right now. First off, I don't know what's going on with the entire Braves lineup. Austin Riley, Matt Olson, Ozzy Albies, Michael Harris, they have all been letdowns, and maybe they're struggling without Ronald Acuña, but Ronald Acuña himself was struggling, and those players were struggling while Acuña was in the lineup. So I don't know that it's related to Ronald Acuña. Marcell Ozuna has been the best hitter in that lineup by far, which is not something we expected to say 2 months into the season. But I would be looking to buy. It's the problem here is the power has just plummeted for Austin Riley. The slugging percentage is down to .347. His ISO is 117. The home run to fly ball rate has dropped from 19% last year to just 5% this season. That is a massive, massive drop. And it's not entirely explained by the data because he's still hitting the ball really hard. 91.2 average exit velocity. That's 80th percentile. The barrel rate is down to 10.3%. He's been up over 13% each of the past 3 years, but even that number is not terrible, right? So it feels to me like Austin Riley might just be off a little bit right now, and there could be a tweak here or there that kind of gets him going. One other thing that I will point out, the fastball usage against him has gone up this season, and Austin Riley has been terrible against fastballs out of nowhere. A .224 batting average, a .320 slug against fastballs this season for Austin Riley. That's never been the case. He's never struggled against fastballs, and typically, you know, those are the pitches that you should do the most damage on. So again, it just kind of feels like he's a bit off right now. For whatever this is worth, if you look at monthly splits by his career, July and August have by far been the best months for Austin Riley. So perhaps he's someone that just kind of needs the weather to heat up and then he starts to take off a little bit. But I would be looking to buy low, and much more so than looking to buy low on Corbin Carroll right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the production is going to be better. I would bet a lot of money that Riley is going to have a better rest of season than Corbin Carroll. It's such a different profile, but as the weather warms up, like you mentioned, he's usually good in the summer, big power hitter. I would be surprised if we don't see at least like 25 to 30 home runs from Riley when we're looking at the end of the season. If you're looking at ATC, they project another 22. The low projection is 17. So even the worst projections, you're still going to get probably 20-ish home runs. That lineup as a whole has kind of been cool. So as they generally start to heat up a little bit, Olson and Albies, I think that we are going to see the whole product kind of turn around. But definitely it has been a disaster. If you started your draft Riley or Carroll and Riley, which I think a lot of people probably did, or some variation of that probably, you're looking at a pretty rough season so far. There's not much that you can really do at that point except kind of hope for the best. But let's talk Bo Bichette. Get to my neck of the woods here in Toronto. It had momentarily started to look a little bit better for Bo. overall, it's still a pretty disappointing season for him. I think that it'll probably turn around, but he doesn't steal bases like he used to. The power hasn't really been there. We haven't had that massive batting average to fall back on. I'm a little worried. How worried are you about Bo Bichette? I think he'll be fine, but I'm not without concern here.
Yeah, I think the weirdest part is that you can always count on Bo Bichette to at least hit for batting average, and he's not even doing that. So that's like the first thing that stands out to me. And the expected numbers still look pretty good in terms of the expected batting average. So I think, if nothing else, the batting average will get back on track for Bo Bichette. I think the power can be explained a little bit by the lack of barrels. It's a career low 4.9% barrel rate, which ranks in the 20th percentile. And his home run to fly ball ratio, like Austin Riley, has plummeted. It's 6.1% this season, 16% for his career. Again, that could be a product of the environment. If you look at the home run to fly ball rate across baseball, it's 10.8%. That is the lowest it's been since 2014. Last year, that was 12.7%. That is a massive drop, nearly 2 percentage points down in terms of home run to fly ball ratio across the league. So we're seeing a lot of these hitters who are not typical power hitters. Like, you look at Bo Bichette, you were expecting, what, 20 to 25 home runs max. Like, even someone like Ozzie Albies, these are not guys that impact the ball all that hard. They really need to make the most of, like, pulling the ball in the air to get to their power. And it feels like a lot of those hitters have struggled most in this environment. The last point I'll bring up, and maybe you could talk to this more, is this: it kind of feels like a Blue Jays team problem. It's just the power is down for everybody, right? Like Bichette, Vlad, Springer. And it feels like it's been that case since the renovations that happened in Rogers Center last offseason heading into 2023. Like, just, it feels like no one's been able to hit for power there. Even Matt Chapman, who had like one of the top barrel rates in baseball last year, couldn't hit for power playing in Rogers Center. So maybe you could talk more to that, but it feels a little bit like, okay, the environment is affecting Bo Bichette, but also just the vibes are weird with the Blue Jays, man.
I hold myself back. There's no restrictions on swearing. If I want to say bad words, I'll say bad words on this show. But I have to hold myself back pretty regularly from just coming out here and swearing up a storm talking about the Blue Jays. It's very, very frustrating. They made these changes that are supposed to make the park a little more hitter-friendly. And if you're looking at park factors this year, Toronto is 24th in overall park factor.
That's bad.
That's really bad. Like, I think that they made these changes kind of with the thought that, okay, we're going to get our guys, they moved the fences in slightly. It wasn't a situation where I was thinking it was going to be harder for them to get the ball out of the yard, but 18th in terms of home run, park factor. And like you mentioned, Matt Chapman, 18 home runs or whatever last season. I think there's part of it is the park, but there's also a part of it at this point that I have to kind of blame the coaching. When it's everybody struggling like this for consecutive seasons, yes, the individual players need to do better, but I think that there needs to be a change in Toronto. And I personally think that it should be top down. Everybody should go. I think that the offseason was a complete disaster. I think they've assembled a team where we're excited about Isaiah Kiner-Falefa at bats. That's where we are in Toronto. When IKF comes up, it's like, okay, he's on a heater right now. He's got hits in 15 of 17. And then when you sit there and you're thinking, Jesus, I just got excited about an IKF base hit. Like, we are down bad, but that's kind of the way that the whole team looks. Bichette, the counting stats are pretty terrible. 22 runs, 27 ribbies. I don't know that that's going to get a lot better when you're trotting out Daniel Vogelbach, IKF, Kiermaier. People are upset about a Kevin Biggio DFA. Like, that's where we are. It's a tough lineup. I don't know that the counting stats are going to get better, but you know, another fallback here is just as the weather warms up a little bit, you'll probably see more of those balls leave the yard, hopefully in Toronto, but especially away from Toronto where you're not dealing with the park. It's really weird, the park, bringing in the fences and then it's harder to hit home runs doesn't really make sense to me. I'm sure there's more data out there that does explain it, but it's been a very tough season as a Blue Jay fan, especially if you have Bichette. I have him on a couple teams and it's been pretty damn tough.
Do you think they sell?
Sell Bichette and Guerrero?
Yeah, because there's been like whispers, but it feels like these were generational players. Like, are they really going to look to sell some of those guys? What do you think?
I wouldn't, because the price you're getting is not going to be what you probably should be getting. Can you just imagine what they could have traded Vlad for after 2021? You could have got Soto for him probably.
But now that's been like unheard. Like, you can't trade a player that young coming off like a second to MVP finish, right? Like,
yeah, so it's kind of... I said it last year. I tweeted it last year, and I still agree that now is the time to extend them when they're not asking for a king's ransom, because they can't be asking for a king's ransom. If you are Blue Jays management, if you are Rogers, this is probably the right time to say, all right, Vlad, all right, Bo, it hasn't been great. We're going to extend you, but they could save themselves probably, you know, $5, $10 million annually at this point if those guys are willing to explore it. Now, they both come from baseball families. I don't think, you know, a lot of these players that jump at those deals where they're a little bit discounted are probably not guys who, you know, come from rich families. That's just one of the things. These guys who come from poor countries, they get offered $70 million, they jump at it. It's a lot different than Vladimir Guerrero, who grew up with a father who's in the Hall of Fame, and Bo Bichette, whose father was a famous baseball player as well, Dante Bichette. So I don't think they're going to jump at necessarily discounted offers, but they're not going to be able to command full price for what they've done right now. And it would be a good time for Toronto to try and extend them. If you're trading them, you're getting maybe not pennies on the dollar, but nowhere near what you should be. I think it would be a mistake, but it would be in line with this ownership group to trade Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero and get back a pittance and then have to start the rebuild that we started only 3 or 4 years ago and haven't won a playoff game since with these guys. It would be a pretty tough pill to swallow, but it's not out of the question they trade him. I'd be devastated. Somebody mentioned Luis Robert, Garrett Crochet or something. Like, if Toronto's willing to do something like that, maybe I'd explore it, but I'm not expecting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's where I'm at as well. I mean, it's kind of crazy just to hear their names kind of bandied about in trade rumors, right? Just like how successful they were at such a young age. But man, it's been such a weird turn of events for, frankly, both of their careers, Vlad and Bo Bichette.
Yeah, and even if you want to look at like Alejandro Kirk, he was on an amazing upward trajectory, and then the bottom has fallen out. Like, he hit a home run yesterday. I was shocked. Like, I was watching the game and I was like, who was that? Oh, it was Kirk. Okay. Second home run of the year. It's really, really been a tough time. Let's move out of Toronto before I get too depressed here and have to end the show. Let's talk Randy Arozarena, who has also been kind of depressing so far this year. .175 on the batting average. Still got 8 homers and 7 steals, so he hasn't been totally useless for fantasy. But this is a guy I get questions probably just about every single day. I'm sure you do as well, about dropping him, cutting him, trading him low. I've been on the buy low train for Arozarena. I think that things will get better. He's running a .212 BABIP when his career number is .318. There's no world where Arozarena ends up with this poor of a batting average. He's still giving you counting stats. I think he's a decent buy. What about you, Frank?
Yeah, this one is a little bit tougher. It hits close to home because I have quite a bit of Randy Arozarena this season. I thought, okay, he's safe for his usual 260, 2020, right? And, you know, in a 15-teamer or any league that has 5 outfielders, like, that is extremely valuable, right? Just to have a player with that floor year in and year out. Now, the way he gets there is he's been very streaky if you look at his month-to-month production. But by the end of the season, Randy Arozarena usually has those numbers. I think there are some legitimate reasons for concern. The plate discipline has been a problem. His zone contact is down to 75.6%, which is really, really bad. The K rate is a career high, 26.5%, his highest since 2021. His line drive rate has plummeted to 14%. So less line drives equals less hits. And his infield fly ball rate is 18.8%. That is tied for 9th highest among qualified hitters. And I usually like to stay away from hitters who have a track record of lots of infield fly balls. And I don't know how sticky it is year over year, but those are automatic outs. I mean, when those things are happening, it's like, clearly your timing is off. You're trying to figure things out. So I think that's what's happened right now with Randy Arozarena. And the low batting average, it's been going on for quite some time now. 135 games since July 1st of last year, he's batting .198. So Almost a full calendar year where he's batting below the Mendoza line. I mean, I don't want to say that he's just like, this is it. This is the end of Randy Arozarena's career. I think he could still turn it around. Oddly enough, another issue I saw is, like Austin Riley, struggling big time against the fastball, 149 batting average, 289 slug. That to me is like the weirdest thing, that, you know, something is off with Arozarena. He crushes fastballs in his career. So just feels like he's off. I mean, he's 29 years old. I'm not ready to say that he's just done. I know there are some plate discipline issues there. I still think he's a talented player. I lean with you. I think he's a buy low. I think it's time to maybe try and warp our expectations. Like, maybe he really is just like a lower batting average guy at this point in his career, like a 220, 230 hitter. But doing that with the power and speed, it's like, all right, maybe he's not the top 20 or top 15 outfielder we thought he was coming in the season, but he's still like a top 36 or a top 40 outfielder rest of the season, something like that.
Yeah, I think the power speed really does provide a nice boost there. But the batting average is interesting. Even if you go back to when he was in St. Louis, and we're talking very, very small sample sizes here, but every single season of his career, his batting average has gone down. If we're talking just the full seasons from 2021, it went from 274 to 263 to 254. And now we've seen the bottom kind of fall out this year. But I saw Vlad Sedler tweet something the other day about how he was available in a 12 teamer. It's like, okay, if he was dropped, it was an OC, I think. And somebody bid like 240, 250 on him, which I think is correct. If you're seeing Randy Rosarena out there on the waiver wire, I think he's probably worth 20-25% of your fab, at least just based on what the potential is. He's another player who's kind of plagued by a bit of a shitty lineup around him this year. 48 runs and RBIs combined in 64 games is really not going to cut it for you. A guy who had 95 runs last year and 83 ribbies. So the whole product is probably a little bit lower. I think what you said is really correct about maybe just lower your expectations a little bit. Is he going to be a second or third rounder? No, I don't think so. But is he still going to be somebody who is definitely worth slotting into all lineups rest of season? I think he is. I really think he is.
I think context is required for the position too. Outfield has been bad. Outfield is really bad, man. We have five outfielder leagues, 12-team roto, 15-team roto, where at minimum, you need to have 60 outfielders rostered. Yeah. And in those 15 teamers, 75 outfielders rostered. My question to people who want to drop Randy Rosarena, who are you dropping him for? It's like, yeah, we have some names that pop up here or there. It's like, you're dropping him for Miguel Andujar. Like, you know, it's just, there's not really much out there. So look, there are shallower formats, like head-to-head lineups. I know a lot of people play head-to-head points and head-to-head categories, like three outfielder leagues. Like maybe it's defensible in a league like that, but like anywhere with five outfielders, there's just no way.
It's crazy the difference there is between like a 10-team three outfielder where there's 30 versus our NFBC leagues where it's 75. Not to mention like utility bench, it's probably closer to like 85, 90. Yeah, 100 even. There's like nobody out there. That's why, like you mentioned, Miguel Andujar, everybody kind of rubbing their hands together when they see Miguel Andujar out there. But yeah, I think if you're dropping a Rosarena for him, that's probably going to come back and bite you down the stretch.
Summer is supposed to be an opportunity to slow down, but when you look at your kids, you can't help but notice that your kids are growing up fast. Help them build independence as they grow with Greenlight. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families where parents can keep an eye on kids' money habits while kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. It's the easy, convenient way to raise financially smart kids. Get your first month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/pod.
Nico Horner has been pretty rough. I know that he was drafted as a bit of a batting average asset with stolen bases. We haven't really seen either one of those. 252 batting average, 7 steals. It's been pretty rough, and he's a bit banged up right now as well. There's something wrong with his hand. It's a small fracture that they want him to play through, which I don't really love that. He's been dropped a little bit. Like, he was close to 100% rostered. I'm just looking at Yahoo. He's down at 88, so people are starting to cut bait on him. Is that the correct call, or do you think there are brighter days ahead for Nico Horner?
Yeah, I think in the Yahoo format, where again, it's like head-to-head lineups, you start a shortstop, a second baseman, there's no middle infield. Those are shallower formats. I think it's defensible to drop Nico Horner in leagues like that. Any league that has a middle infield spot, I think I would still hold on. It's been a disastrous season for Nico Horner, but and it might get worse. I mean, you mentioned this small fracture in his hand that he suffered this past weekend. Like, there is a real chance that this actually gets worse for Nico Horner. What stood out to me is the BABIP is down from 312 to 274. As a result, the batting average has been a disappointment. If Nico Horner is right, the one thing I would bet on is like, this guy's going to hit 280 plus. Like, the batting average is going to be there. He's not going to give you much power, but like, you know, when he's going right, like last year, it's good batting average, runs scored, steals. Obviously not many RBI and home runs, but you knew what you were drafting when you selected Nico Horner. The other issue is that he's just not running as much this season. He's currently on pace for 17 steals after 43 last year. And this is a reminder that stolen bases are really weird in fantasy. Like, you'd imagine someone as fast as Nico Horner would just run wild with these rules that we've had the past couple of years. Again, we saw it last year, but not so much this year. It's just a reminder that like, steals are something that of like a mindset, right? Like, you need to have the intent, you need to have the aggressiveness. It's a lot of it is timing too, like the right at bat, the right pitch to run on. So it's like, steals are weird, they're tough to project, and I think we're getting a reminder of that this season with Nico Horner. So again, if he were fully healthy, I think The batting average is going to jump back up. I think the stolen base pace would increase as well. But the fact that he's now dealing with this injury, he's not a name that I would be looking to buy low on. And in some of those shallower formats, I do think it's defensible to drop Nico Hoerner.
I agree with you. I just don't know that, especially with playing through a hand problem, a fracture, like how is that not going to just get worse? How do they expect that to get better? Like that's going to hinder the way he swings the bat, you'd think, which is probably going to be another roadblock, at least temporarily, for this batting average, which is already at 252 through 250 plate appearances nearly. It is a concern. And I think the lineup as a whole, we're going to talk about Dansby Swanson in a second, but this lineup as a whole isn't really doing them many favors. Christopher Morel is very inconsistent. Bellinger hasn't quite been what we hoped. Seiya Suzuki can't stay healthy to save his life. So this is not really a robust lineup like I was kind of hoping it would be, especially with some of the disappointments. And to segue that into Dansby Swanson, he has been pretty disappointing himself. There's not a lot you can really point to this year that's been that valuable. 226 batting average, 6 homers, 4 stolen bases. I'd be all right in those really shallow leagues because shortstop is so valuable. Like if you're seeing a Mason Winn out there on the waiver wire, potentially, would you make that swap for Dansby Swanson, or are you still trying to hold on where you can?
I think in a shallower format, that's fine to like kind of ride the hot hand. You know, the difference with Swanson and a lot of these other players that we've talked about is that he's not an elite fantasy contributor. We know that, right? Yeah. Like he's somebody who routinely is solid. And he's usually a big help in deeper leagues just because he plays so much, right? Where, you know, just playing time and getting those plate appearances, it matters so much in those deeper leagues where you just want players that have a really good floor. And that's who Dansby Swanson is. If you play in a shallower format, each one of your roster spots needs to be occupied by someone who is making a difference. And if Dansby Swanson is not, then I think you can drop him for someone who has the hot hand, like a Mason Winn. As you mentioned, some of the issues this season for Swanson have been self-induced. His 27.6% K rate and 51.5% ground ball rate are both career highs, but he's still hitting the ball hard. His average exit velocity, 90.4. It's an 11% barrel rate. The expected stats say that Dansby Swanson has been pretty unlucky so far this season. So if you play in a 12-team roto league with a middle infielder spot and anything deeper than that, like a 15-teamer, I think Swanson is totally fine as like a buy low option. And I'd bet on him being better the rest of the way, maybe hitting 250 with like 10 to 12 home runs, 7 to 10 steals the rest of the way. And, you know, in some of those deeper leagues, that's something that's actually really valuable.
It's just shortstop for me. And I know a lot of the questions that I get are like people play in 10 team leagues, they play in 12 team leagues. Like I know we talk a lot about the 15 team format, and I've realized over the last couple of years that there's not a hell of a lot of people who are playing in those deeper leagues outside of us who talk about them a lot. But if you are playing in a 10-teamer and you're seeing a David Hamilton, you're seeing Mason Winn, you're seeing even Paul DeJong, who's been just really on fire right now. I don't trust it as far as I could throw him. But if you are kind of in those shallow leagues, it does kind of make sense to churn around a little bit. And I don't know that Swanson's upside is necessarily high enough in those 10-teamers. In the 15s, you're absolutely correct. There's just nobody else that you're going to be dropping him for. Like we mentioned earlier, you're going to pick up Miguel Andujar or whatever. No, you're sticking out with Dansby Swanson. But another player where I've kind of changed my expectations a little bit, 80 and 80 in terms of runs and RBIs is very unlikely to happen. That's kind of been, I mean, even 2022 was 99 and 96 with the Braves. We have to kind of change our whole expectation of him and say, in my opinion, I think that he's like, going to probably fall short of 20 homers. Maybe you get the 10 steals, but there's not a well-rounded asset here, I don't think, in shallow leagues. You're holding in deeper leagues because there's not really much else out there, but there is stuff out there in those shallow leagues, and I think it does make sense to at least explore what's available to you. I like Mason Winn a lot. I think I would make that swap if you're talking about a 10-teamer. Nolan Arenado has been not great. Now, they've started to turn things around recently, but as a whole, Arenado is still batting 252, 6 homers. It's not been great. Some people were very in on him coming into the season. I was pretty interested. A lot of people were starting to think that this was the beginning of the end with the aging curve. I think that there are still some brighter days ahead for Arenado, but I'd also understand people thinking that we're starting to get into the decline phase here. Where do you stand on Arenado, Frank?
Yeah, probably more so that this is the start of the decline. 33 years old for Arenado, and the power has plummeted like a lot of the names we've talked about here. The slug is down to 370. His ISO is 118, both of those career lows for Arenado. And I'm not so sure it's exactly just because of the environment. Again, it's He's getting older, and some of this is self-induced. You know, his quality of contact is way, way down. Average exit velocity is down nearly 4 miles per hour from last year. 85.9 miles per hour ranks in the 8th percentile. His 3.5% barrel rate ranks in the 10th percentile. So this is not something you would expect from somebody who was supposed to give us, you know, 25-ish home runs this season. Maybe the ball flies out a little bit more as the weather heats up, but this really does feel like the start of the decline where Arenado becomes just kind of one of those fringe corner infielders where he hits 250, gives you 20 home runs, and there are just so many players that can provide things like that. So, yeah, I'm more in the camp of, like, not necessarily looking to buy. I think this could just be the start of the decline for Nolan Arenado.
So in those 10-teamers, you think you'd be all right to say goodbye to him? I feel like I'd have so much trouble actually hitting the drop button on just because of the name, right? But
yeah,
based on the stat line, maybe it does make sense at this point.
The difference between Arenado and is the position, right? Like, we were talking about Swanson, like, third base has not been as fruitful as shortstop. So there, it's not like there's been many names that have popped up, like some shallower leagues. I know Candelario's been out there and he's been hot. So something like that, I think that's fine. Like, you can ride the hot hand, but it's just, I don't think there are many hot hands available at the third base position as there are at shortstop. So I don't think it's crazy in like a 10 teamer or like a 12 team head to head lineup, again, where there's no corner infielder, but I just don't think there are many options at the position.
Maybe you can take the name value and get something out of him if you're trying to trade him as opposed to dropping, because I think the name still carries some weight. I talked about Justin Verlander on a show yesterday, the day before. He's not been doing very well, and the metrics are trending in the wrong direction, but his name is still Justin Verlander, and you might be able to parlay that into something a little bit better than you should. And maybe that's the case with Arenado, where you're able to come to the trade table and you say, look, he's still Nolan Arenado. You don't really get into the advanced numbers so much when you're talking with whoever you're trying to trade. And maybe you're able to get something back as opposed to just straight up cutting him. Because as crazy as it sounds, I mean, in those shallow leagues, you might be able to get away with it in those 8-10 team leagues. It's possible. I know it sounds crazy. I would never have thought we'd be having this conversation about Arenado, but it has been pretty rough. It's been very, very rough for my boy George Springer. Hard to call him my boy at this point with what we've seen. Dropped down to 5th, 6th in the order. Barely just got the batting average up over 200. Actually, it's right on 200. But we're not seeing much power. We're seeing speed, which is kind of weird these last 2 years. As George Springer's gotten older, last year he had his first 20 stolen base season. He's already got 8 of them so far in 59 games, so that's kind of a positive. But again, the Blue Jays lineup is just god-awful. Springer has 13 ribbies. I think Luis Matos had more in that 2-game stretch than Springer has for the whole season. He's not leading off anymore. I think that you're all right. We were talking earlier about 10-team, 3-outfielder leagues where there's 30, 35 outfielders rostered. I think it's all right to cut him. Do you see anything that would really stop you from cutting bait with Springer at this point?
Not in those shallower leagues, the 3-outfielder ones. And in the 5-outfielder leagues, it's not to the same extent as a Rosarena, because a Rosarena has, you know, a higher ceiling, and we've seen him be a better player than Springer the past couple of years. But even in 5-outfielder leagues, I don't know that you're going to find much better than George Springer. And, you know, I know the batting average and the home runs are way down, still contributing some steals and runs scored. I think, like Arenado, this could be the start of the decline. Springer is 34 years old, and his quality of contact has plummeted quite a bit as well. It's a career low, 85.9 average exit velocity that ranks in the 8th percentile. His 5.9% barrel rate is also a career low. The power has been trending down for years now, too. So Springer just doesn't look like the same player that he once was. And it could be explained somewhat by more ground balls, 53% ground ball rate. I mean, that's a career high. It's not close. I mean, this is someone who, at his best, he's hitting the ball in the air, he's pulling the ball, and he's getting, like, you know, 25, 30 home runs. When you're hitting the ball on the ground and you're just not impacting the ball as hard as you used to, this is how you're going to wind up with like 4 or 5 home runs on the season. So I do think the batting average will be better. He still does not strike out. Still really good plate discipline for Springer. His expected batting average is 260. So I think that will get better. The power, maybe he gets to like 12, 15 home runs, but he could do that with like a 250, 260 batting average and 20 steals. It's not a terrible player, but it's also not an impact player like maybe we thought coming into the season.
Yeah, the thing that might save him a little bit is Toronto's ineptitude, and they might put him back to the top of the order just because that's where he's been comfortable. Even though the on-base, even with a 10%, almost 11% walk rate, the on-base is 288. But Toronto doesn't do things the way that you'd expect, and I have heard chatter around these parts that they do want to put Springer back up there. And David Schneider has been struggling a little bit as of late. So I think that might be a saving grace potentially if you're looking for a bright spot, but I don't think the power's really coming back. Maybe he's able to keep stealing, which is able to keep some of the value up, but yeah, I think the bloom is fully off the rose. And the last, what is it? One more year, two more. I think he has two more years on the contract. They're probably not going to be looking terribly great here in Toronto. I wonder if George Springer in the offseason becomes, I don't know if they DFA him. That's probably a little bit too extreme, but we're talking $25 million for a guy who's, I mean, got a 0.3 wins above replacement at this point in the season. I don't think it's crazy to think that Toronto might try and get him off the roster next year, one way or the other, as opposed to paying $50 million for age 35 and 36 George Springer. That's pretty rough. Yandy Diaz, speaking of rough, has been pretty terrible. I remember the thing that really stuck out to me. This was right after I got off the plane from Arizona, getting back in Toronto, and Steamer had just released their projections that day. And I remember seeing Yandy Diaz, and he was like fifth or sixth in projected WRC plus. And I was like, okay, maybe he can do it again. He has not done it again to this point. He's batting 254, only four homers. The counting stats have been all right, 25 runs, 29 ribbies. But Yandy Diaz, in my opinion, especially at a fairly deep position like first base, is probably not someone you need to be holding on to in shallow formats. What say you, Frank?
Yeah, I think that's totally fine. And I think we may have gotten duped by a 31-year-old coming off a career year last year. Because if you look at his career, it's typically 10 to 15 home runs, really good batting average. Now, the batting average is down this year. I would expect that to be better. But the power, I don't think we're getting back to 22 home runs or anywhere close to that. He still hits the ball really hard. The problem, as it has been for his entire career, way too many ground balls, nearly a 57% ground ball rate. And his pull rate is way down. I mean, a lot of times, like mentioned it earlier, you want to get into that power. You really want to pull the ball, especially in an environment where the ball is not traveling as well. And Yandy Diaz is just not pulling the ball right now. So his home run to fly ball ratio has plummeted as a result. I think the batting average will be better. My expectation rest of season, maybe he winds up with like 12 home runs and he hits like 280 plus, which is fine. Like we said, with a lot of these players, like in a deeper league, it's a good floor. He's going to play every day. He's leading off for Tampa Bay. That's fine. But in terms of like impact difference maker, I don't think that's going to be Yandy Diaz.
Yeah, I think that's fair for a lot of these guys. 15 teamers, it's just like if a guy's a cut in a 15 teamer, he's got to be really, really terrible. And as bad as Diaz has been, there is still some upside with the batting average. Hopefully that lineup can improve. But it's another team that's kind of a theme today with these teams that have kind of disappointed, and that has kept not only just because the players are disappointed, but the teams around them disappointing as well have kind of kept all the fantasy value down for those Cardinals, for those Blue Jays, for those Cubs.
The Atlanta Braves.
The Braves. I mean, I was putting together my pitching, my starting pitcher streaming chart, which I update every few weeks. And I was tempted to put the Braves into like a streamable territory, but I can't do it to myself. And it's insane. Can you imagine if somebody told you in March you'd be streaming pitchers against the Braves, Nationals pitchers against the Braves, and they'd be dominating? Like that stretch last week where it was Jake Irvin with a masterpiece, Mitchell Parker, Trevor Williams. Are these the Braves or the Rockies? I don't know what to make of it, but yeah, I think it just speaks to the whole theme, which is offense just sucks this year.
I saw this tweet from at Codify Baseball. Since April 24th, no MLB team has scored fewer runs than the Atlanta Braves. Think about that. I mean, that's almost a month and a half that we're talking about of the season where they have less runs scored than the Marlins and the White Sox.
I probably could be justified in throwing them into the streamer bucket, but I just know the second I say stream a guy against the Braves, that's 10 Ernies, four homers, and it's going to be just – it's going to eventually come back, I think. And the thing with the Braves is, not to get sidetracked, but the Braves, even with all their struggles and all the injuries and everything that terrible that's happened, seven games above 500.
Yeah.
It must be nice to be a Braves fan, although it's probably a little tough this year. I will say you guys lost your two best players, and that obviously does suck. Let's go move back into Tampa Bay, another team that has been really just awful. Not just Yandy Diaz, but Josh Lowe. No, it's Josh Lowe. I always mix up the Lowe's and Lowe's. It's Josh Lowe. Brutal. Absolutely brutal. Now, he has been dealing with injuries. He's only played 18 games, but when he's been out there, 30% strikeout rate, .213 batting average, zero stolen bases, and zero stolen base attempts. We got 32 steals, 20 homers, and a .292 from him last year. Similarly to Yandy Diaz, maybe did we get duped a little bit and buy into the career year? I know that he's younger and it's a little bit different, but same kind of thing, you think, where you got kind of duped?
Not as much. I don't think that about Josh Lowe. I think for certain players, this happens every now and then where you just kind of get a doomed season. And that's what it feels like for Josh Lowe. He's been limited to just 18 games, a few oblique injuries that have popped up. And obliques are tough, man. They are things that could linger. You know, the ability to swing the bat with authority, you know, the quick twitch that you need on the base pads and stuff. I know that's like more related to your legs, but I, you know, sliding and things like that, like it affects your upper body and your oblique in general. So I just feel like oblique injuries are, those are ones that could just completely derail a season. It's really hard to judge the numbers for Josh Lowe because it's such a small sample size. He's only played the 18 games, but everything is bad. The quality of contact, the K rate is up to 30%. It's way too many ground balls. Maybe I'm just giving him the benefit of the doubt. I did draft him in a few places this year, but given the trajectory of his career and, you know, the prospect status that he had, he came up a couple of years ago, he failed. Then he was a post-hype sleeper last year and he broke out and had this awesome season. And at the age that he was at, it didn't feel like we were getting duped. And I don't think that that's the case. I just feel like he's really, really been doomed by injury. Another one where like, in three outfielder leagues, you absolutely can drop him. He doesn't even play every day. He doesn't play against left-handed pitching. And I'm not saying he's a drop in five outfielder leagues, but like, I think you can bench him. I think you can bench Josh Lowe for like the foreseeable future and just kind of like try to find anybody who's a hot hand in the outfield and maybe just run with that player. I still think the upside is really high. Maybe it takes him a couple of weeks, a month to get like fully healthy and he has a big second half. I wouldn't rule out that possibility, but like, shallow leagues, absolutely a drop. And in five outfielder leagues, I think I would probably bench Josh Lowe right now.
Obliques have become the hitter version of elbow injuries or forearms, it seems, over the last little while. Josh Lowe is somebody where there's still so much potential. It would be very tough to actually cut him, even in those deeper leagues. Like, let's say there was a league where David Fry was still out there. Who do you think has a better rest of season outlook, David Fry or Josh Lowe? Who would you rather have?
I would still bet on Josh Lowe. Look, David Fry has done awesome things this year, and there are reasons to believe it's not going to continue, like some of the expected stats and stuff. I don't want to downplay what he's done because he's come out of nowhere and he's been awesome. I think the other part of it is like, I don't want to use David Fry anywhere outside of catcher. I just feel like that's where his value is so useful. I think I would still bet on Josh Lowe, but that could turn out to be one of the dumbest things I say all fantasy season.
Well, I said, when I mentioned that show I did with Erickson a few weeks ago, and I said Bo Naylor is going to be better than David Fry rest of season, and now I'm thinking, I'm not so sure about that anymore. Yeah. Let's talk about somebody that I am really not sure about, and that's Cedric Mullins. It's been a tough couple of years. The trajectory has been, 2021, he went 30-30. He looked like the next kind of breakout, and then it's gotten kind of progressively worse every single year to the point where he is batting .174. 13 steals and six homers are kind of keeping him relevant enough where he's not like a completely useless fantasy player for you, but he's not playing every single day. When he gets into the lineup, it's 7-9 in the order. Cedric Mullins is just barely over 50% at this point on Yahoo. I think you're probably all right to cut him. If you look at the last 30 days, batting .141 with no homers, it's just really the speed, and I feel like you can kind of find speed if that's all you need. You can pick up a Caballero or somebody if you need speed in a lot of cases that aren't killing you the way that Cedric Mullins is, especially in a part-time role. I just don't know that there's a lot here at this point, but he's one of those guys, again, where it's very tough to actually hit the drop button just because we know what he's capable of, but is he going to get there at this point? I'm not sure, Frank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned the power and speed. He's still on pace for 14 homers and 32 steals. It's just everything else, the counting stats, the batting average, a disaster for Cedric Mullins. The strikeout rate is a career high 25.6%. The expected numbers are awful. It always kind of felt like Cedric Mullins was walking a fine line because he wasn't great in terms of quality of contact. He never really got on base a ton. It's not like he had this great plate discipline. And He hits lots of infield fly balls. I mean, that is something that's consistent with Cedric Mullins' career. So, like, again, those are automatic outs. And now the Orioles are loaded with talent. So, you know, they have that luxury of benching Cedric Mullins, and, you know, they don't have to play him every day. A couple of years ago, they had nobody on the roster. So he just, all right, go out there and, you know, do whatever you can. And, you know, he obviously made the most of his opportunity, but now things are a little bit different with the Baltimore Orioles. I think of all the outfielders we've talked about today, dropping Cedric Mullins is the most defensible one. Like, that, this is the one I could get behind the most. The fact that the batting average is so bad, he's really only providing steals. He's not playing every day. He's even getting benched against right-handed pitching now, which is just, I could get it against lefties, but even against righties, it's, that is a serious problem. So of all the names we've talked about, I think Cedric Mullins is probably the most droppable.
I feel like there's got to be a trade coming. I've been saying it for a while that I feel like Baltimore needs to make some moves. And they got Corbin Burns, but they didn't move off of any of those. I mean, they got rid of Joey Ortiz, but in terms of the top tier prospect, and Joey Ortiz has been actually great this year, but the top tier prospects that they have in their system, the Norbys, the Mayos, the Kierstads of the world, where the hell are they going to play them? There's no room for everybody. They're going to have to deal a couple of them. And also, they're not going to have 100% hit rate with their prospects. Rutschman and Henderson hit. Holiday, I would still expect to hit. But these guys are not all going to be first-round superstars like Rutschman and Henderson have been. I feel like it's probably wise for the Orioles to at least see if they can get another ace back. They've had a lot of pitching injuries this season. If they can trade a Norby and a Mayo or a Norby and a Kierstad or something for, I don't know, a top-tier pitcher of some kind that's going to be available at the deadline, I would probably be doing it if I were them. I'm surprised it hasn't happened already.
Yeah, it's just trying to find which pitcher is available. Like, the most likely name to be traded, I think, is Jesus Luzardo. He's not an ace by any means. He's more of like a 2-3. I mean, maybe he even slots in behind like a Grayson Rodriguez, something like that. I don't know what other pitchers are going to come out on the market, but that feels like a pretty good match right there, right? Like, you get Luzardo in that big ballpark. He gives up some hard quality of contact, but as a lefty, he's got that big cutout in left field. So it feels like it would work. And I don't know that you'd have to give up, I don't know, even the top prospect. Like, I don't know, who would you have to give up? Kobe Mayo? I don't think so. I think you could probably get it done with like a Connor Norby or maybe even a Kierstad. So it kind of feels like a pretty good match there.
I know that Eric Fetty's probably going to be available. That would make sense if they make him available. I know that Toronto's mentioned Yusei Kikuchi. That would be kind of a tough pill to swallow trading within the division, but left-handed arm in that rotation would probably make sense. But we'll see. We'll have to see. I just expect that Baltimore is going to have to make some of these trades because they're going to have a starting nine that's all like 22 and younger pretty soon. I don't know how viable that is. And I don't even know if there's room for all of them. They can kind of, you know, do this little jigsaw puzzle, but they're not all going to be playing at their natural positions. And there's going to be a lot of young guys without a lot of veteran presence in the lineup. I think that it would be wise for them to make a trade. And we'll probably see that at some point. Last guy I want to pick your brain on, Frank. I talked about him on my waiver wire show earlier today. It's Zach Geloff. And I'm at the point where I don't think that he's really worthy of being rostered outside of, like we've mentioned, those really deep leagues at this point. Playing for Oakland, not even playing every single day, at the bottom of their lineup while hitting 190. I don't see a lot here unless he really dramatically turns things around and starts getting a lot more playing time, but he's not doing a lot for you right now. I think you're pretty justified in dropping Zach Geloff.
And I think there were signs of this last year too, because the plate discipline was so bad. I mean, a sub 75% zone contact, that is really, really awful. That's what he had last year. That's what he has so far this season. And we've seen the strikeout rate jump up to 33%. Some of the quality of contact stuff has been a mess too, like 49% ground ball rate. We didn't see that from Zach Geloff last year, but the ground ball rate rising in conjunction with the strikeouts and just playing for the Oakland A's, it's a really big ballpark, so it could be tougher to tap into some of that power as well. He's turned it on a little bit recently, right? Past couple of weeks, he's looked a little bit better. The power and speed, strikeouts are still there. It wouldn't surprise me if we get a Zach Geloff heater at some point. And, you know, he's worthy of being rostered in those head-to-head lineups where you only start like one second baseman. But yeah, I don't see much under the hood to be excited about outside of just this recent stretch run from Zach Geloff.
What I don't understand is why won't they just play him every day and see what they've got? Why are they playing games, platooning a guy who is still, how old is Zach Geloff? 22, 23 years old? Is he even 23 years old yet?
24.
24. Sorry, he's 24. Fangraphs. Well, I'm still getting used to the new Fangraphs here, so forgive me.
Yeah, me too. It's tough.
But he is 24. Why the hell wouldn't you just put him out there every day and see what you got? You're only going to do more damage, in my opinion, doing this back and forth in and out of the lineup. Like, I really like what the Yankees did with Volpe last year. Volpe struggled a lot, and they kept him up. They kept him in the lineup, and he worked through at the big league level. And look at what we have with Anthony Volpe now. He looks fantastic. Not to say that everybody's Anthony Volpe, but I would much prefer to see guys work it out at the big league level. That's why it pissed me off when Edward Julian got sent down. I get that there's a roster crunch, but what are these guys going to learn sitting on the bench half the time or playing in AAA? I'd much rather see the team give them a chance, especially these Oakland fans. Why not let them see the young guy over his last few months and with the team in the city? I don't really get it. Do you understand why they would be platooning him?
No, I mean, I will say this, looking at his game log, he's only sat out like one game in the past, I don't know, dating back to May 14th. So I don't think he's sitting out too much, but they should just play, right? Like, they should just, why not? It's like the Oakland A's are not playing for much, and he's young, and he flashed so much upside last year. I mean, the thing with Edward Julian is just so weird because they choose to keep someone like Kyle Farmer around on the roster instead of Edward Julian. Like, that to me makes absolutely no sense. I mean, even if you just continue to platoon Julian and play him here to there, like, yeah, it's these teams that look, the Twins are much better than Oakland. There's no doubt about that. But you know, it's like they're trying to find offense any way that they can get it right now. And not that Julian's been great, but yeah, I totally get what you're saying. And for a team like Oakland, Geloff should just be out there and playing every single day. And hopefully he refines that form from last year.
No, you're right. I did overstate that for whatever reason. I thought he'd been sitting a lot more than he actually has. He sat the other day, but mostly he is in the lineup and just giving you offers, which you could argue is about the same value to you. Yeah. Frank, it's been great catching up with you, man. I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Yeah, no doubt, man. Happy to be here. Happy to do it. It's a busy time. It's a fun time. We're middle part of the season. And Joe, let's just hope for the sake of at least your Blue Jays that the offensive environment changes and we start to get a little bit more pop and some home runs rest of the season, because it has been a struggle, my man.
Well, for your sake, for your Yankees, I hope that Juan Soto, I'm going to say a prayer for him every night until we know that he has a clean bill of health.
Please.
Definitely not looking forward to the potential of Juan Soto in my division for the next 10 years. My late 20s and early 30s are probably going to be a bit of a tough stretch if that's the case, but always fun getting to catch up with you, Frank. Why don't you let everybody know what's going on over at CBS before I let you out of here?
Yep. Again, you can listen to Fantasy Baseball Today. That's our full-length, hour-long podcast. It comes out weekdays. We go live on YouTube very late at night. So if you're on the West Coast or if you're just a night owl, we usually go live around like 12:30 a.m. Eastern time. So you can come watch us live on YouTube, or you can catch the audio podcast. Again, that's in the feed Monday through Fridays. If you don't have as much time to dedicate, we have a 5-minute podcast, Fantasy Baseball Today in 5. And you can follow me on Twitter, X, I never know what to call it anymore, @Roto_Frank.
I'm just stuck with the Twitter thing. I don't know. The X thing is weird. And what are you going to say? You X'd something, you re-X'd. I don't know. I'm just stuck with the Twitter thing for the most part. Yeah. But definitely make sure you're following Frank on whatever you call it, the old bird app, @Roto_Frank. Make sure you're checking out everything that's going on over at CBS. The guys do fantastic work. And I know that Frank puts in just a stupid amount of time into that show sheet over there. You can tell just from listening to the show. So definitely worth your time over there. We'll be back again tomorrow. We'll be looking at Tuesday's box scores, talking about the big pickups and drops of the day. But until then, everybody, take care. Have a great night.